Welcome to The Buzz with ACT IAC, your source for the hot topics and top issues affecting the federal technology market. Join us each week to hear insights from government and industry experts, stay informed on the challenges facing the public sector, and gain access to valuable reports and thought leadership. Enjoy.
Morning, everybody. Thank you very much for coming. We have a limited amount of time, Mikey, so I propose that we start by talking like the guys in the FedEx commercial a couple of years ago, where everybody talked really fast so we could get more information in. Is that okay?
Okay, sounds like a plan.
Okay, that's a great idea, so let's get started. Believe it or not, we didn't rehearse that. Since we do have limited time, let's get right to it. What is the mission of the U.S. Digital Services the way you've stood it up, Mikey?
Okay. This is something I should really have prepared, it's to enable, to facilitate, to help, to coordinate with agencies to be able to better execute their mission as it relates to citizen-facing services.
So there was an apprehension when 18F came out of the General Services Administration. A lot of the folks in this room expressed that apprehension. And they have gone a ways toward helping to get rid of that apprehension. There's a little bit less apprehension about U.S. digital services and its relationship to industry and how it all fits together. But why shouldn't the folks in this room worry about that extra layer of connectivity in government? Why will you help them be able to work with their government partners better?
Can you be a little more specific about what's the worry?
Sure. The apprehension about 18F in particular was essentially pointing at what they were doing and saying, I thought we were supposed to do that.
I see. Sure. Is stuff like 18F, U.S. Digital Service, going to suck up the oxygen that was previously?
Yes.
Okay.
If they're going to be the innovation people, right. How are we going to get involved with that too?
I'll talk about, I represent U.S. Digital Service. I know I can tell you a little bit about 18F, but I'm sure there's people who are more qualified to do that are already here. What I see us as doing is basically I don't think there's anything to worry about. And here's why. When I worked on healthcare.gov a year ago, that's how I came to be mixed up in this whole thing. And I know, I can't really see because there's these lights, but I know that there's people out there that I must have met on healthcare.gov by reading the list of sponsors up there. What they told me, again, and I spent a ton of time with people working on, with the contractors working on healthcare.gov, average 17 hours a day, 7 days a week in Exchange Operations Center in Columbia, Maryland. So we had a good amount of quality time to spend with people who have been in this business for a while. What you told me again and again and again was virtually everybody working on that project wanted to assure me and the others that had come in from the outside that this was not, they can do better than this. This was not their best work. And it was not their best work for a bunch of reasons. A lot of which were the government's fault, a lot of which were the oversight, a lot of which were the management of the project, the structuring of the contracts. There's lots of things that could have been done better. And so all the people that I brought from the outside, they would do their work. We were mostly incident response, day-to-day management kind of stuff is what my group did. Every single one of them, without exception, would do this for a couple weeks, and then they would want to. Then they would be ready to talk to somebody. They want to tell anybody who'd be willing to listen about. You have to stop making these structural mistakes. That's what leads to these kinds of outcomes, and it will happen again and again and again. So, those are the ideas that led to the thing called U.S. Digital Service being formed over the next few months. So, I really see it as, if what everybody tells me is true, then the private sector and the government will both be happier if the government did a better job at managing and supervising and overseeing these contracts. Because there's good reasons why most of this work should probably always be done in the private sector. The private sector companies, at least in theory, have the freedom and have a certain amount of flexibility to create a work environment which should be more attractive to retraining, to attracting top technical talent. Like you have advantage. I'm saying you as if I'm talking to the contractors right now, because I know a lot of you are. You have advantages that I don't. You can pay people more than GS-15 Step 10. You can set up offices the way you want to do it. You don't have to rent them through the same way that I have to do it. You don't have to go through the same hiring processes. There are a lot of reasons why you ought to be able to outcompete just by attracting a better workforce, and that's fine. That's great. It'd be impractical anyway. Like, there's no chance of bringing, what's the conservative number, $80 billion of government spending a year on IT? Like, there's no chance of us taking all of that on. Like, if we were fully funded for 2015, like, I think we asked for, depends how you, what you count exactly, but it's somewhere between like $8 and $20 million. Mm-hmm. So like, if we were fully funded for 2015, my group were talking about, that's a half of a tenth of a percent of that spending. Mm-hmm. We need to be as leveraged as we can possibly be. And I think one of the best ways that we can get the most bang for the limited number of people that we have is by enabling the existing establishment to do better work in the context they're already used to.
Mm-hmm. Is there an analogy that you can think of for what your service will be between industry and the agencies? I think of connective tissue, like the ligaments between the bone and muscle. Is that appropriate?
I think that's a good one. Maybe I'll use that next time.
You're welcome. That one's free.
It's we do. I really look at us as being there to fill in all of the gaps. So we don't. That's the thing that makes us unusual compared to most other players, even inside the government in this space. So, for example, 18F operates on a different business model, mm-hmm. Which is cost reimbursed, right? Mm-hmm. And they act similar to a vendor or a supplier. If you have a specific project that you want to get done, one of the ways you can get it done is you can hire them, and you interagency agreement, blah, blah, and they complete the project, they deliver the project. They're about delivery. We U.S. Digital Service, go to where the need is the greatest and whatever the need is. I mean, it should be kind of technology related, ideally. But a lot of what we do turns out to not even be that. It's just management of projects, mm-hmm. Which is fine because we're OMB. There's management and Office of Management and Budget. But we don't. I see us as needing to be a lot more adaptable because the different agency needs are unpredictable. Mm-hmm. It's not the same thing time after time. There's a lot of commonality, but it's a different thing each time.
Mm-hmm. What is your biggest challenge as far as being able to bring people like you who come with a Silicon Valley mindset and have a perception, at least, that working for the government is not going to be nearly as appealing as the very fast-paced perception that people have of what Silicon Valley is like, and how do you get them to stay once they get to Washington?
So there are a few surprising things. So what? I'm not very organized in this answer, sorry. Before they could convince me to come work at U.S. Digital Service, which was a process that took some months, my biggest worry about it was what you just said, was even if I'm willing to come do this for some reason, it makes sense to me, the day after I accept this job, I'm going to be supposed to convince 10 or 20, or it's not really clear, but a whole bunch more people to do exactly the same thing, and how am I going to do that? Like, what are the tools going to be to do that? The experience with that so far has been not what I would have expected. Last year, and I guess it should have been what I expected, because last year when I worked on healthcare.gov, it was the easiest. I got the ability to bring in more people from the outside around November or so, it was the easiest recruiting job I have ever had. Like, and I've been working for, I worked with Google for 8.5 years before this, and I did a lot of recruiting, managing the hiring process there too. And with all of the advantages that I had at Google, it was still very hard. It's extremely competitive for like the fairly limited number of, the talent pool that you want as far as people that have experience building large-scale public-facing systems that have high expectations of reliability and uptime. That talent pool is pretty small, and it's fiercely competitive. And you can see that with how much money they get paid in the private sector. And so it was very hard to recruit people, even with all the advantages of the in the private sector. And yet, when I came to work on healthcare.gov, of the first 12 people that I called and said, you know, would you consider working on this thing, I think 10 of them came and did it. And they took time off of their other jobs to do it. And the reason for that is they care. People are very interested in the kinds of missions that only the government has. There is nobody else. If the government doesn't make healthcare.gov work, nobody else is going to do it. It's written into the law. Like it is the way it is. And there's tons of other things that if the government doesn't do them, nobody will. There's not a startup working on fixing like food stamp delivery in San Francisco. The government is, and Code for America is. There's not a startup working, well, okay. You know, if I hand wave over a couple of little details a little bit, then there's not a startup in Silicon Valley whose job is to fix the, you know, disability claims backlog at the VA. Mm-hmm. Government has to do that one way or another. And people are very interested in working on those problems, like unbelievably so. When we started this thing, I gave, even before US Digital Service got started, I was doing a thing going around mostly Silicon Valley, talking to mostly technical audiences about the thing that I had done on healthcare.gov to encourage people to consider doing the same thing, because I don't see any reason anybody couldn't do it. Like, you can take a leave of absence, you can get yourself hired at a private contractor or at an agency, whatever. There's a certain amount of appetite, people are willing to do it. I mean, the agencies and the contractors are willing to do it a certain amount. There are now last number I heard was 750 people that are in the queue that have expressed some degree of interest that we haven't. Our bottleneck is processing them. It's literally processing the paperwork, getting them an offer. Like, it's not budget. I have budget. It's not demand. I have plenty of demand and I have plenty of supply. Literally the bottleneck right now today is processing hiring paperwork.
We could do the whole rest of the program on special hiring authorities and the mechanisms that I'm sure you'd love to have, but unfortunately we can't do that, or we'd probably put some of these folks to sleep. I thank you very much for coming in and participating in this conversation. I mentioned the apprehension that people have expressed, but I know that overall the concept of something like U.S. Digital Services is something that a lot of the folks in this room are looking forward to seeing develop, if it means that you're going to be that connective tissue between them and the agencies where help is needed. So I welcome you and I thank you for coming today.
Thanks.
Mikey is going to stay with us for the panel discussion, and if you have questions you'd like to direct to him, I invite you to save those for the rest of our conversation. Would like to welcome now to the stage the other participants in our breakfast panel this morning. Kevin Cook is the Chief Information Officer at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Kevin Mahoney is the Chief Human Capital Officer at the Commerce Department. Marina Martin is the Chief Technology Officer at the Department of Veterans Affairs. David Robinson is Associate Administrator in the Mission Support Bureau at FEMA. And Melissa Sterinsky is the Chancellor of VA's Acquisition Academy. I want to welcome you all to the stage right now. I will say, Mikey, as our friends get seated, that I am glad that they had the chairs all set up for us, because I was anticipating something like a Cher concert where I have to figure out something to do while somebody comes in and changes the sets. Friends, thank you all for coming today. We just have a couple of minutes, and I'm not going to ask you all to talk like the FedEx commercial guy, because we did that joke already. So I will just say, one of the themes that I detected as we had conversations about what we were going to talk about today was communication. You all discussed communication on some level or another, and why communication is important and why improving it is important. So I'll start with Melissa. When you were on the program not too long ago, you talked about how you're teaching the people who go through the Acquisition Academy about communication and how and when and why it's okay and in fact necessary to communicate with people like the folks in this room. So why don't we start there?
Sure. So we promoted the VA Acquisition Academy, a concept called market intelligence, which basically means getting out there and talking with industry on a regular recurring basis so that we better understand the industry capability that's out there. And by doing that, we can shrink our requirements definition phase of the entire acquisition lifecycle because we're more informed, we're better informed about that industry capability out there. That results in better proposals from industry and better mission outcomes. So it's a tough nut to crack, really getting people to think differently. A couple of things that we hear from the acquisition community, both on the program side and the contracting side, is we don't have time to meet with industry. Or if I meet with one, I have to meet with everyone. How do I maintain the integrity of the process? So we try to develop that mindset through the training and promote that discipline amongst the acquisition community.
Kevin Cook, the theme, the communications item that came out of what you and I talked about ahead of time was a communication across the CXO suite at your agency. In particular, you mentioned the chief procurement officer, chief acquisition officer role, and how that communication is important with you. Another one that I hear from CIOs a lot is discussions in the CFO office as well. Tell me about what you're thinking about there, please.
Sure, Francis. I have to correct one thing. You said I'm not the CIO, I'm the deputy CIO. My boss is here, so I don't want to take his job.
I warned you, I can only read what's on the screen. I can't think for myself, so I apologize.
Maybe it's the future. one of the things we definitely talked about was the teamwork that's needed across all the operations offices. One of the kind of daily struggles that we have is how do we procure things in a more flexible and agile way, trying to look at a lot of things that we can do collaboratively with the vendor partners that are here. And as you guys talked about in the opening session here, a lot of the rules and the processes that are in place sometimes prevent some of the innovation that we can do together. The issues with the CFO, again, you know, they're always a good friend and partner in everything that we do, but just again, sort of the budget process. When we look at the budget that we receive for long-term projects and having to sort of get the trickle of funds in on that, so some of the long-term planning becomes to be a little bit difficult if you can't have a steady and dependable flow of dollars into those projects. So those are just some of the challenges that we face, but again, always looking for new ways to collaborate and to move forward on that.
Excellent.
In the spirit of teamwork.
Thank you very much. Kevin Mahoney of the Commerce Department. Some of your colleagues from Commerce and former colleagues are here. And collaboration at the C-suite level is another element is also important at your agency. You wrote about change management in the notes that you sent to me. And change management, of course, is at its core communication, expressing to people how we're going to move forward, why we're changing, and all of that. Tell me where you're coming from there.
So we've been embarking on an enterprise approach to HR over the last 4 or 5 years. And we've been moderately successful in implementing some of it. And along the way, what we've really found out is that we didn't spend enough time on the front end trying to get everybody to understand what the outcome was at the end. And so as I look back at what we did a couple of years ago, and as we're going forward in a more shared services environment, we're really spending more time on the whole sort of idea of how do we institute change management so that at the end, the outcomes are what we want them to be. So the communication piece for us is critical as we try and automate some of the transactional things that we can do and free up people's time to be more strategic in their jobs.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Marita, thank you very much for coming. It's good to see you again. Communication in a technologist role, I mean, you're pushing information up and you're spreading information out. Tell me about the techniques that you use to make sure, besides just going and getting in somebody's face, that make that work.
I think it's really making sure you're communicating early and often. Something I've been encouraging vendors who are working with us is if we give you, you know, a set of requirements, feel free to talk back to us and explain why something may not be the best choice. You hear a lot about government requesting cement boats, which I will say I did learn you actually can make a floating boat out of cement. If you see something like that from us, we need to know, and we need to have a lot more of those conversations very early and often. VA is actually standing up its own digital service team with Mikey's help, and I see that group as very much being navigators. You know, in those first 6 months of your contract, do you want to deliver PMAS documentation and a PowerPoint slide, or do you want to deliver on a working, functional app that's impacting the lives of veterans every day? And if we communicate upfront, early, often, and get really clear about where we're going, we can move a lot of those hurdles out of the way. And with the same resources, we can get a lot more done.
Excellent. Thank you. David Robinson of FEMA, you wrote about outcomes, and you wrote about the leadership commitment at FEMA. And that is along a similar vein, I think, to what Kevin talked about, where everybody in the C-suite is sharing information. And it also fits with what Kevin Mahoney talked about change management. Yep. Tell me what is on your mind there.
So at FEMA, we've been very mission-focused. Obviously, we're trying to be survivor-centric and make sure that each community and each individual survivor of a disaster has a good and similar experience in getting the help that they need. But the leadership of FEMA recognized that there was some fundamental things missing. And so in our last iteration of our strategic plan, we included as one of our main strategic priorities to strengthen our organizational foundations. And really what that means is we're bringing the back office to the front office. And our speaker last night talked about strategic plans are supposed to be action, you know, compel people to action. Well, nothing compels people to action more than having it as one of your strategic priorities that's funded, that gets leadership attention each and every single day. So we're bringing things like building and strengthening the workforce. We're doing things like understanding our IT and understanding it in ways that we've never understood it before. Things like this help the communication, because in the past, you know, I represent most of the shared services or the support services for FEMA, but in the past, if there was a problem with IT, or if there was a problem with HR, if there was a problem with facilities, it was my problem. Now, because it's a strategic priority for all the leadership, it's our problem. It's a FEMA problem, and we work together through that regular communicating, regular reporting, regular dialogue about the what would be previously the back office type functions. Now we're talking about that as a normal course of business, as an important and imperative type course of business. Mm-hmm.
Because this is interactive and we want you to participate and collaborate, and we're going to go to questions in just a moment. I have one more. Mikey, I want to come to you. How have you seen communication be different or the same in your government role as it was, for example, when you were at Google?
I would say, so there's government has a couple of complications. There's the oversight environment, there's FOIA, there's a bunch of stuff that we just don't deal with. So to get that out of the way up front, like to be fair, there's some complications that you deal with in this sector that you just don't if you're working at Google or Facebook. Now that being said, something which is the same, or at least it works or fails in the same way in private or public sector, is if you have a climate where people do not trust that their information will be taken in good faith. So I see a problem. I'm working on healthcare.gov. I know that this thing is not going to work this weekend. If I bring that up and I get punished for bringing that up, obviously I'm not going to do that next time.
Right.
You have to, in either place, you have to create a climate where you're encouraging people to share correct information, which means not shooting the messenger, which means, you know, being willing to work together to solve the problem. And that's really a leadership issue. Mm-hmm. And you know, good leadership is good in both places, and poor leadership is bad in both places.
Should government people think the way that they do, which is, oh, things are so much different in the private sector? Gosh, this would be so much easier if I was in the private sector. I could just move on things.
There's a ton of the grass is greener in that mindset. I mean, sure, some things are. Like I said, when I worked at Google, I didn't have to have my email FOIA'd. You could still go through discovery in a lawsuit. It's basically the same thing. It's not really that different. A lot of that, the government does not have monopoly on slow bureaucratic decision making. To one of your earlier questions, the most success we're seeing right now in bringing in people from outside is people who come from relatively big tech companies, because a 50,000 person company is a 50,000 person company anywhere. Mm-hmm. And they are used to it not exactly being the way it's portrayed on TV with like Silicon Valley decision making. Now people that come from, people that have never worked in a company bigger than size 10, yeah, they have a little bit more culture shock when they get dropped into the government.
Thank you all for those comments. We have microphones floating around. If you have questions for the audience, we have a mic over here, one in the back, or on this side. The only rule is please tell us who you are and who you're with, and then who you would like to direct your question to, or let us know that it can be to anybody, and we'll start right here.
Good morning. Diane Ashley with Lockheed Martin. This is probably across the panel. Would you talk about, in the era of reduced budgets, programs that you have for affordability, affordability processes, whether it be on the contractual side or maybe changes you're making on the programmatic side to address affordability?
I'd take a stab at that. One of the things that a couple of years ago at FEMA, we recognized that we were in significant budgetary straits. So we tried to figure out what do we need to do, and our choice was really binary, space or people, and we chose people. So we've embarked on what is really turning out to be sort of a best in government solution to do what we call workplace transformation. That's where we're consolidating space, we're consolidating our footprint. We had eight facilities in the National Capital Region, and we're going down to one. We're doing that by knocking down all the offices. Nobody has an office. Everybody's in open space. We're using technology to help us to facilitate that because we're now, everyone's got a laptop, everybody's got a phone that goes with them. Everybody is mobile, everybody is expeditionary, so they can work wherever they are. And we're also finding that we're saving millions and millions of dollars in what we were paying in rent. Now we're able to afford the people that we need to do the work that we're doing. So that's one example of where we're taking sort of the GSA model, if you will, and sort of doing that on steroids. And now we're starting to move that out to all of our regions where we're shrinking our footprint significantly. We're creating these open and collaborative environments that people can work in, and they're frankly finding it to be extremely good, not just for dollar savings, but in terms of the way we work. We're trying to think differently about the way we work, and that's been very helpful. If a person is working at the headquarters in a collaborative environment, they know that when they get deployed to a disaster, it's the same there. And so we're teaching people to work the same way everywhere, no matter what.
Anybody else have something they want to throw in on that?
Sure, I'll take a stab also. We are a federation of about 12 bureaus, and each of those bureaus has their own particular culture to it and their own set of resources. So frequently what I hear is, I don't have the resources to get the job done. And what I've come to understand, part of my job is, if I take a look across commerce at the 650 plus people who do HR, my job is really to figure out how to use all of those people to get the work done. And when you look at it from that perspective, you all of a sudden realize not only do you have the resources, you have more than enough resources to figure out how you get the job done. So as long as we stay in this environment where I have my set of folks here and I have my set of folks here, it's tough to get work done. But if you look at it, again, more from a holistic approach, you really can begin to move the needle in a lot of different areas.
Can I?
Thank you. Oh, Melissa, sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I have a comment that I think will strike a chord with many of you in the audience. I don't think that LPTA will yield us the savings that many think that it will. So
you understand how long the line will be to talk to you later, right?
So, yeah, of course. Okay. And so, right. You know, and I spent most of my career in operational contracting, and I can't think of a time, maybe once, that I did LPTA. And so we are a big piece of this is better program management. So a lot of the training that we offer at the Academy is geared toward the project officers and program managers across the VA, really helping teach them and give them the tools to better manage their programs, to find some efficiencies, internal administrative efficiencies, as well as cost savings that we might be able to yield by better understanding our requirements, understanding industry capabilities. So that's a big offering that we have in the Academy is how do we really control costs? How do we yield cost savings through better program management? And another offering that we're building right now, we just recently piloted it and we'll be pushing it out, is a critical thinking series where we're bringing the entire acquisition team together to learn together. And one of the things that we'll have in that offering is critical thinking in the context of a source selection decision. So really getting the acquisition team to understand that if you go with LPTA and somebody is a dollar higher, yet they give us a significant technical superiority in their proposal, we cannot award to them. And so getting people understanding downstream implications of decisions they make early on in the acquisition process are critical. So you absolutely have my support in the Academy. We are not pushing or promoting LPTA. Understand it's a challenge government-wide right now, but it's not going to yield us the savings that many think that it will.
I have to let the applause dissipate, Kevin. Whenever somebody in government says they don't like LPTA, you get the applause, yeah, so I had to make sure that Melissa got hers. Go ahead.
As we talk about shrinking budgets, I think in the technology field, this is a time of excitement. It allows us to be more creative. As these guys talk about reducing space, we've got to come up with more ways to reach our constituents, our employees, wherever they are. So it's the ability to use more mobile technology to take advantage of a lot of things that are out there. We do have to do some increased project management, some bad word oversight, but in order just to bring things a little bit closer in terms of efficiency and effectiveness. But it's an opportunity, again, in my mind, for technology to expand its role in terms of being able to support what needs to happen in these other areas, whether it's reducing space, reducing the amount of data that we use or using it in a better way, that we can take advantage of data mining, business intelligence tools. So I think there's better ways to do things, and this is an opportunity for us to really sort of step forward and help our partners in those efforts.
Marina, I follow on to the concept about budgets. I had a conversation with a federal CTO, not you, not too long ago, and we talked about the concept of that job becoming having a little more pressure associated with it because you're the brain, you're the big thinker, show us some shiny object that can help us save money. Is it your sense among your colleagues in that community that that is widespread across agencies, that that is an expectation, that you and your team are going to be able to provide, show people new technologies that are going to save a lot of money and they're waiting on you to provide answers?
So I think the role of a federal CTO is still changing and is different at every agency, but I would definitely say that in my role at VA, it's a lot about bringing that modern technology, helping people inside understand what that is, and helping make it something that they want and that they understand. You know, we should be building responsive websites that are on usage-based elastic cloud hosting. So if we have $1 million, we can build 17 things for a veteran instead of, you know, one-fifth of one thing. Mm-hmm. So bringing modern technology and making people comfortable with it, because it's new, and new is always scary, and you're not sure if you're allowed to even buy it or in certain cases. I think really opening that communication, and I think having the new digital service team will help a great deal with that because they'll really be ambassadors to modern technology, to finding ways that we can leverage it within our agency.
Excellent. Another question for the panel. We have, where are we going? Oh, right here. Coming over here next.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'm Anderson. Can you hear me? From Unisys. This is a bit of a follow-on to Melissa's comment about acquisition. I believe that one of the big barriers to being able to bring innovation into the government, particularly around some of the larger programs, is in the acquisition process where companies want to come in with a very innovative idea. There's a very delicate balance for us in a high-stakes procurement between bringing an innovative idea forward and knowing that you all, as you level the playing field, don't give that away to our competition and are able to evaluate that, which is the bigger challenge, I think, particularly where the acquisition and program people don't necessarily have the tools to offer that kind of evaluation criteria and be able to avoid protest. Could you please address that?
Sure, and I think that's a really valid point, and I think in the market intelligence training that we are planning to offer, we're going to address that head on, that we have to be very careful that we maintain the integrity of the process and not turn over those innovative solutions as we define the requirement and put it out there for the rest of the world. So it's a tricky balancing act, and I think that's why we see the resistance amongst the community is a fear of how do I do it in a way that maintains the integrity of the process, enables me to get smarter about the capability that exists out there so that I can shrink my requirements definition and get good proposals in and better mission outcomes. So it's tricky.
The question that she's getting at, though, I think, is there's another layer to it, and that is something I hear out of DOD all the time, which is the evaluation. And how do you teach your people to appropriately evaluate a couple of different choices so that they don't have to default to LPTA? The sense that I get is that a lot of decision makers default to it because they know they can't make a mistake if they do it that way.
Right. Well, and clearly LPTA limits innovation because you all aren't going to give us that best value solution to us. And so I'm very concerned that we're not getting the quality that we need or the outcomes that we need. But again, reinforcing in all of the training that we need to evaluate proposals in accordance with the evaluation criteria. We need to do what we tell industry that we're going to do to be able to select that best value business partner moving forward.
David? But so, yes, I agree. Training is a piece of it, but and it's not just the people who are evaluating the proposals, but it's also the people writing the proposals. It's people who are the program managers. I sit at FEMA as the component acquisition executive. And so one of the reasons I'm not staying for the conference tomorrow is because tomorrow all day we're having an all-day session with every single program manager at FEMA to start that training and learning process so we can do the collaboration, so we can help program managers to better understand what their programs need and how they can best describe those things. That's one of the many things we're going to be talking about. But it's an important lesson not just for the PMs, but it's a lesson for acquisition or procurement professionals who are helping to write good contract requirements and helping the program, not just the program managers, but the executives in the programs who are defining what that program needs to be in that very beginning defining the program requirements. If we can build it in so that it's not automatically defaulting to low price, then and automatically defaulting, for example, to best value, then I think we get a better conversation with vendors, and we can have that more open dialogue.
Kevin Mahoney, we're down here talking about acquisition people and their people, and I wonder if you're involved in these conversations as much as you should be or as much as you'd like to be, because they're right in your portfolio too, not just our acquisition friends over here.
No, I get involved in a lot of those things, and I think what we're coming to understand more and more is that the community of finance, IT, HR, acquisitions, if we're not working collaboratively on a daily basis, then we're missing something. And so, you know, these partnerships that we have inside the agencies with folks like Steve Cooper, who's here, who's our CIO, are critically important to us. I've got to understand what the business needs are so that I can help go find the folks that help them get their work done. Similarly, you know, they have to provide us with the information we need to go do that work. So we can't operate independently. We just will fail if we do that.
Mm-hmm. Mikey, are these the kinds of conversations that make your friends from Silicon Valley's eyes glaze over?
A little bit, yeah. I'd only add one thing, which is that we're never going to be able to design a process which is going to give good results if the people making the decisions don't understand what they're buying. In too many cases, the people who are making the decisions don't understand what they're buying. So if I was going to address one thing, and I am trying to address this one thing with the U.S. Digital Service, then it would be that there needs to be for the contractor, for the vendor, for the supplier, you have to be dealing with a partner who has a certain level of base competency in the technology itself. So that's just a skill thing that we have to get better at on the government side.
Okay. Melissa?
Well, so
yes.
To that point, I think, too, that On the contracting side, again, we promote, don't be afraid to ask that question. I remember I was buying complex IT services 20 years ago, and by no means am I an IT expert, but I can remember talking with the technical experts about what is it, put it in layman's terms, what problem are we really trying to solve? And before you know, you can put pen to paper to write a requirement, it's really important to understand what it is that we are buying. So we have an obligation to make sure that we're asking those questions, and don't be afraid to ask the question.
Thank you. Promised we were going to go over here.
Mark Foreman from TASC. I wonder if the group could answer how they're approaching the reinvestment issue. So the OMB said this past year, reinvest 5%. The opportunity is probably in the order of 50% reinvestment that's got to occur. But the big issue has nothing to do with technology. It's more the rice bowls issues within the agencies, because to take advantage of the reengineering means ultimately that people who have their own silo and their own systems aren't going to have that anymore. They're going to have to take advantage of services. And that loss of control seems to be a bigger barrier than understanding the technology. It's more the willingness to take advantage of it. So how is that being approached with this reinvestment initiative in your agencies?
I see a lot of head nodding, so I'm going to start with Kevin Cook down here, and we'll just go down the line.
So a lot of what you talked about is the where the money is in a lot of agencies, which is in the programs. And so through time, they've been able to, within the program dollars, to invest in a lot of technology. And in those silos, that works when, you know, budgets are fat and everybody has plenty of money. But as things do get a bit tighter and we're trying to do some consolidation and work more closely together, that is the largest part, is convincing them that those things that they've taken time to build can now be taken advantage of by the larger agency, but they won't lose, you know, total control of that. There's still some application decisions. We just talked about what's the real problem we're trying to solve around requirements and those kind of things that, as we're listening very closely to them and talking about requirements and making sure that we get closer to the business, I think we can convince them that we have the best interest of everyone and invest together into those new technologies and working together to reinvest and yielding those savings back to mission activities versus some of the other things that we're doing. So,
David? So Mark, you're asking exactly the right question, because all of us are facing that very thing. We found at FEMA that we're spending, you know, $400 to $500 million a year on information technology, and yet our good friend Adrian Gardner, who is our CIO, only controls about a third of it, which means that all the other IT that's going on out there is somewhere else, and everyone's going to, you know, keep their, you know, you'll pry from my cold dead hands. So one of the efforts that we've done is, I mean, Adrian's mantra has always been from day one, I don't need to own it to influence it, but I need to understand it. And so what we've done is embarked on about a 10-month venture to understand our IT spending, understand our IT systems better by going region by region by region and program by program throughout FEMA to uncover where the systems are, what the systems are, who they are, who's owning them, and what do we spend on them. And we're just now at the point where we have that inventory. It took a lot of time and effort to do that. Yeah. But frankly, as we were going around, we were finding that even the people who thought they knew what their systems were didn't know. They were calling things systems that really weren't. But if you're spending a lot of that money, and maybe a third or two-thirds of it is on operation and maintenance tail for something that you purchased a long time ago, you should know what you're spending your money on. You should know that system is really critical to be able to, if you're going to sustain it and use up precious resources to sustain it. So by getting everybody involved in that process that was led by Adrian, it sort of opened up the window of understanding to IT, so that now we can have the conversation about what is critical, what is common, where can we leverage each other. We've got 85 systems out in our regions, and not one of them they're all doing the same kind of work, but they're all doing it with different systems. So how can we leverage that to everyone's benefit? I think it's been a good effort.
Melissa?
And I would just say, with complex bureaucracies and the human dynamic
The loss of control, it's always going to be a challenge when we're trying to take on an initiative like this. But I think to the extent that we can help people understand or answer the question, what's in it for me, and you know, get them to see that or understand that. And so really important that we rely on the right data and are able to put that data into a business case that clearly articulates the what's in it for me answer.
Excellent, thanks. Sure. Mikey?
I think there were some good answers. I'd just add one thing I think helps is if you're right, it's always going to be hard. The loss of control is always going to be a thing. There's a lot of resistance. One thing I think helps a little bit is the more you can try and persuade people to look at it through the customer's eyes instead of their own, because then the answer is usually obvious. If you say, if I am J random person in Iowa who wants to sign up for healthcare.gov today, do I care whether it is this vendor's data center or this other vendor's data center or whether this agency whose name I don't even know owns it or this other agency whose name I don't even know owns it? No, I don't care about any of that stuff. If you can get people to think of it that way, then, you know, and the last thing I would throw in is that the illusion of how much control people think they have over their old environment is usually another thing that you can attack with some success. you think you want to do it this way because you're comfortable with it and you've been doing it this way forever, and you're also down 25% of the time and have always been. And if you're so in control of it, then why can't you get that number any better? And you know, that's a hard question to answer.
Marina, you're nodding your head very enthusiastically as she's talking about the customer.
Yeah, unsurprisingly, Mikey and I have exactly the same answer. Your focus can't be on prioritizing systems that are up just because they've already been up, and it can't be about breaking down silos for the sake of breaking down silos. It has to be about presenting a unified experience. And you know, VA is undergoing a period of transformation. You may have seen this in the news recently. And I think what's really going to, the next step here is really being veteran-centric, really being customer-centric, really putting ourselves in the shoes of that veteran. Because as you said earlier, you know, when with enough budget, silos continue to work, but I actually think there are still negative side effects of those silos. We just don't see them as much. And it's the budget that tends to bring it to the surface. But yeah, framing it as positively as you can from the customer experience perspective is really what is going to bring those silos down.
Kevin?
Well, I can't say it any better than what's been said already. My experience is if we're not meeting the needs of the customer, then we're just not being successful. In lean years and fat years, you know, it's going to vary. And so this focus still has to be on how do I deliver this service so that the people who use it actually get something out of it.
We have just a few minutes left, so we'll try to squeeze one more in so we can get done on time. Where do we have another one? We can't be done already. All right, I'm going to take the last one then, and just a thumbnail to wrap up. Kevin, I want to start with you. We began our conversation talking about communication. Give me a thought that each of the folks in this room, whether they're a vendor or an agency person, can take back to the office and do something with tomorrow or tonight if they skate out a little early. Go ahead.
I think the biggest thing that I would think about there is a quote, seek to understand, just making sure that we communicate well back and forth and that we come out with a common understanding from whatever conversation is that we're having with a common goal. So.
Excellent. Thanks. David?
I would say that in my space, just because I have all of the support service components doesn't mean that that's where all the support service work is being done. And the advice that I would give is that as you're developing plans of action and you're developing your thoughts around how you need to take your agencies or your organizations to the next level, involve the whole community. The whole community of people that are doing the same kind of work, regardless of whether they're in your organization or not. But sort of we call it a mission support community at FEMA because it involves all programs. But it really does get people together thinking about how we can do work better regardless of where it is.
Excellent. Thanks. Melissa?
Trust. I think we need to trust in industry. We need to trust in the acquisition system. We need to trust with our internal business partners that, you know, there's positive intent there. And I think in some ways we've lost some of that trust. I don't know, you know, what's happened, but I think we need to restore trust.
Thank you. Mikey?
If I could implant just one idea in the entire ecosystem, it would be let's do less planning, less talking, more doing, more experimenting with things. Mm-hmm. I bet every single one of you here spends a huge amount of your time working on strategic plans and stuff that's more than a 12 months in advance. And if we're really honest with ourselves, how often does any of that stuff ever matter?
Thank you.
Building on what Mikey said, it's your responsibility as Americans to provide veterans and your fellow citizens with the very best service that you can provide them. So if we don't ask for the best thing, you need to talk back with us and communicate and explain what is the best thing. And that's what we need from you.
Excellent. Kevin?
And I would say that I think this is probably the most exciting time for government as we transition from one generation of federal employees to the next generation. And I think we would all agree that the next generation comes equipped with a bigger set of tools than we ever had. If I were to be honest, I would tell you when I graduated from college, high technology was carbon paper. So think of where we are today. And the critical thing really, I think, is if we don't prepare ourselves to manage this generation of new employees, we will really miss a unique opportunity.
Thank you for that comment, Kevin. Thank you for your attention, and have a great learning day today.
And that's a wrap on The Buzz with ACT IAC. Join us next week for more hot topics and top issues affecting the federal technology market. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on your favorite podcast platform. And follow us on Twitter at ACT IAC. More information about today's show can be found in the episode notes. For more insights, visit www.actiac.org. Thanks for listening.